to calculate what the field strength must be to produce that voltage, then you can use a simple calculation. That's a very simple calculation, and I've seen it. I've seen it in the reference manuals. I've never really seen it in any practical application. I've also seen it with respect to loop antennas, for particularly small loop antennas. And then again, it's something that you can work in reverse. You can measure what the output of the loop is and figure out what the field strength would have to be to produce that induced voltage. K2RW from KD2BD.
Okay, when you set up a loop antenna for HF, for very low frequency reception, I can sort of see that. But you said you want to know what voltage comes out of a random length piece of wire into your receiver. Well, back up a little bit there. Your receiver has a 50 ohm input impedance. If you don't do some kind of impedance matching, you're not going to get anything into that receiver. So to think you're going to make a pure open circuit voltage measurement with the instrumentation that exists in the average ham shack, or the instrumentation that sits in the average electromagnetic interference laboratory, represents a problem. Back to you, John.
I think what some folks do is they take a small, low-power effect transistor, and they'll put the e-field probe to the gate transistor. They'll have a 1 meg or a 10 ohm resistor from that point ground, and they'll ground this piece of electronics goes between the active and the 50 ohm output, which will probably be off the source of that transistor. So in other words, they use a small power field effect transistor in a common drain configuration, input on the gate, output off the source, and they'll bias it up so that they get some pretty decent dynamic range out of it, and they'll put that in a little box. The DC power up the coax, and take your signal down that same coax through a bias T network, and they'll call it an active antenna, and some folks stick something like that up on their roof, and they're able to do some SWLing or long-wave listening without having to worry about any tuning adjustments, resonance, or anything like that to worry about. And have a wideband receiver, and they can tune from DC to light and pick up from DC to light. K2RW from KD2BD.
On paper, that sounds good, John. I got two problems with that. Number one, how did you determine the bias voltage that's on the gate of that field effect transistor? And number two, if that's a real piece of wire in air, how do you keep the electromagnetic impulse being picked up from that wire from wiping out your field effect transistor the next time there's a lightning storm 3 miles away? Over to you, John.
I guess I'd have to look at the schematic of one of those active antennas to give you a solid answer. Some of the folks who were involved in long-wave listening use antennas just like that. And I imagine there's some sort of diode or Zener diode protection on the gate. I understand fully what you're talking about. But these things exist, and some folks have used them with some pretty good success. For listening on low frequencies, you don't need a very long antenna, and if you're in a fairly quiet area, that e-field probe might work out fairly well. Oriented vertically, and you'll get vertical polarization. K2RW from KD2BD.
Yeah, that's called an e-field probe antenna. And antenna amplifier, it's a line-driving amplifier. They usually have something like a half mega-ohm resistor going to the gate, determining the gate bias voltage. So the amplifier, the antenna is going into a nearly open circuit, but never a perfectly open circuit. And there's got to be back-to-back diodes, RF chokes, whatever, to protect you from lightning. And even that might not be enough. It's a dangerous antenna as far as the amplifier is concerned. That amplifier is extremely vulnerable. What kind of a mail have we gotten this week, Mel? K2KEY, K2RIW.
This is K2KEY. I wanted to book through a few of them, and somebody is sending me these math problems on electrical math problems, and oh boy, I think they're trying to catch a stick. This is the bottom line, because this stuff is not, as you just said, this stuff is just not viable. Yeah, theory, but I think they read Walt Maxwell, though. Maybe he picked it out of Jackson's book, but I think we'll just let that go for the time being on this and go on to something else, Dick, over.
Okay. Occasionally, a simple math problem really does demonstrate some good principles. I could talk about the current that flows in the center of a dipole antenna when it's being fed in a gamma match or a delta match manner, or a folded dipole manner. And I could make that, I could pose that as a math problem. And I did do just that last week. The guy who heads up the antenna department for a particular company in Schaumburg, Illinois, happened to be in my laboratory, and I gave him my dipole puzzle. And because the puzzle is so unorthodox in what it asks and what it requests for an answer, it's a Gedanken experiment, a thought experiment, but when it's properly discussed, it does demonstrate an awful lot of antenna principles that you guys have heard me mention on this net a few times. And I've often said that the principle itself, which I think is useful, is not worded in any antenna book that I know of. And therefore, a vast number of engineers, amateurs, scientists, whatever, have much, much less than ideal knowledge of how the driven element of a Yagi antenna works, or how an ordinary dipole in free space works. The way it's explained in the books is very shy of what relatively simple information could be given, in my opinion, to create much more understanding. Therefore, the antenna becomes much more easy to live with, impedance match, and whatever. That antenna, a simple dipole, and what voltage it picks up when it's into a 1 microvolt per meter field. That drives a lot of people up the wall. So that kind of math, I think, is worth discussing. You be the judge. And maybe you've got a better, more universal piece of mail you receive, and that's your choice. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Most definitely. We leave these math ones from Peter or Cutie, you know, with things like this. And I just don't think that, let's stick to what amateur radio operators are looking for, really that are practical right now for what they're doing right now as far as amateur radio, ham radio operators, the usual ham radio operator. The theoretical of some of these math problems is great, but I think I'm getting a little bit off the deep end, getting into too much theory involved, Dick. I think we're going to lose a lot of people. All right, here's one. A reading here. I understand antenna repeats every electrical half wave along a transmission line. Can you explain simply? I'll go with the simply again. Can you explain why the SWR seems to change along a transmission line? Simply, please, Mel, you know how to do it. Dick, you gave me a bad reputation here of making everything simple, over.
Why don't you take a crack at that first? Related to a slotted line or electro wire, in my opinion. Take a crack at that first, Mel, and then I'll give my slightly longer-winded usual answer. You know, I'm verbose. You got it, Mel.
Okay, let's see. If I have to answer this question, how would I do if I'm standing in front of a group? Okay, let's start. Have you wondered why the antenna impedance repeats every electrical halfway? That's what I first did say. The power, okay, let me phrase this correct. You listen to me carefully, Dick. The power coming from the transmitter is basically what we would call an electromagnetic wave that travels down the transmission line, or up the transmission line, whatever you want to call it, but travels into the transmission line from the transmitter to the antenna. It is one electrical wavelength long. That means its voltage goes from 0 to a positive peak, and then to zero again, then to a negative peak, and then back to zero again in one electrical wavelength along the transmission line like an AC waveform. So far, so good?
I'm with you, and I can picture that waveform standing alongside, drawn as a graph alongside of the transmission line. And if I wanted to, I could take that graph piece of paper and slide it to the right toward the antenna, and that's exactly what that wave is doing. It's sliding along that wire. Go ahead.
Gotta keep this simple. No formulas. No, nothing. I'm gonna try to continue. I'm picturing this in my head. Actually looking at it. Looking at it, like you say, if I had special eyes that I could see this actually going. Now, when it arrives at the antenna, some of the power goes into the antenna, but if the antenna impedance is different from that of the transmission line, some of the power is now what we call reflected. Leave it at that and let you critique that. Over.
Okay, I've absorbed that, and now it's your choice. Do you want me to proceed from there, or do you want to proceed? It's your choice.
Let me just finish this now, my thought, and then it's all yours. This starts another electromagnetic wave, but this one is going in the opposite direction from the first one, all right? It's going back towards the transmitter, in other words. So now, at every point, every point along the line, the voltages from the two waves begin to combine. But when their polarities are the same, the voltages will add. And when they are opposite, they will subtract. This is actually what we call standing wave. Did I say it correctly? Over.
You sure did. And that's exactly what a slotted line will measure. And I bet you've used one of those in your day. Go ahead.
That's what I'm picturing. I'm picturing this. I'm trying to make this simple. So, okay. Now, the voltage and the current. Now, both change with the distance down the line. At some places along the line, the voltage will be maximum, and at others, it's going to be minimum. So we call that VSWR. You've seen that. VSWR, voltage standing wave ratio. So it's the ratio of the maximum to the minimum. This is what is actually happening on your line. Now I can bring in Ohm's law. If we want to continue with this, I have to bring in Ohm's law, Dick, over.
And then you're going to get mathematical. You may not have to. We may be able to explain it as a long string where somebody is shaking one end and then somebody does or doesn't shake the other end. So we don't necessarily have to get mathematical unless you want to. Your choice. Back to you, Mel.
Yeah, I won't get really mathematical. I'll just say that Ohm's law, that impedance, using Ohm's law and impedance, is equal to the voltage divided by the current. That is the relationship. So the impedance, again, is equal to the voltage divided by the current. That is the relationship. This is how a SWR bridge, VSWR, this is where it comes from. How the situation is, how does it get back onto the line? You know, I see it's hard to picture it. You know, how's it coming back down? Well, there it is. It's like if you had a hose, maybe make it with water, maybe visualize it. If you had a hose and the water was going to a fountain that, you know, kind of a fountain that would be spraying the water, you know, in some kind of a nice internal fountain. But the water couldn't, the hoses supplying more water than that valve that the display could take, so that what was happening is bulging out. It's coming out of this the hose and kind of leaking back down the outside of the hose. In other words, trying to return to the source at the where the water comes out of the source. In other words, it's like an overflow. That's what we're talking about. Over.
Yeah, you could run the hose up the side of your tower, and you're squirting water out of the nozzle up top, but the nozzle is leaking, and some of the water leaks out of the nozzle and comes running back down the outside of the hose, running back down the tower. It's a little bit difficult to see a standing wave in water. You can definitely do it with dropping pebbles in a puddle, dropping a pebble in the north end and dropping a pebble in the south end, and you'll do it simultaneously, and you'll watch those waves fold through each other with no interference, which is kind of strange. You have to accept the fact that the magic of a transmission line is the signal will flow down it and will go to the load, whatever that is, and stay there if the load is exactly 50 ohms when you're using a 50 ohm transmission line. That's the good news. The bad news of a transmission line is if it sees anything but 50 ohms, anything but 50 ohms resistive, if it sees 1 ohms of reactance, or if it sees 1 ohm of error in resistance, 49 ohms instead of 51 ohms, a calculated amount of power doesn't get absorbed by that load, it reflects back. The second piece of magic of a transmission line is that the signal that flows up the transmission line toward the antenna, and the signal flowing back from the antenna toward the transmitter, the transmission line keeps those two signals completely separate. It doesn't mix them. That's the hard part to believe. The transmission line doesn't mix them. But if you've got a slotted line really is a transmission line that's got a slot on one end, and you can stick a probe in there, and you sense the voltage that's on the semiconductor. And as you slide that probe on its carriage along the transmission line, the probe is not directional. It looks at the signal flowing forward, and it looks at the signal flowing back. And it sums those two signals together. The probe sums them together. The transmission line doesn't do that. Transmission line keeps them separate. So, because you've got a signal flowing forward, you've got a signal flowing back, there are places on the transmission line where the two signals add up in phase.
Repeater, timeout.
By in phase, I mean if that's the place where the signal going up hit positive and the signal coming back down hit positive, at that exact location, the probe on your slotted line adds the two together, and in the worst case, you'll get twice the amount of voltage. The forward voltage and the reverse voltage get added together. And because the signals are flowing in opposite directions, when you go a quarter wavelength closer to the transmitter, you're a quarter wavelength advancing in phase on the forward going signal, you're a quarter wavelength and retarding the phase that you send of the reverse flowing signal. That's the equivalent of taking the big hand and the little hand, they were both at 12 o'clock, and I'm going to change each one of them by a quarter wave. The big hand is now going to go toward 3 o'clock, that represents the forward voltage. The little hand is going to go to 9 o'clock, that represents the reverse voltage. I've advanced one a quarter wave, quarter of the clock rotation. I've retarded the other a quarter. Those two voltages now, 3 o'clock and 9 o'clock, are pulling against each other, and they cancel. So a quarter wavelength back from the peak, you've got a valley. In the worst case, when there's a big reflection, there's no voltage there because the forward and reverse are exactly out of phase with each other. And when I go another quarter wave, the signal that started off at 12 o'clock went to 3 o'clock and is now at 6 o'clock, that's the big hand. The little hand, in my example, started off at 12 o'clock, went to 9 o'clock, and now it's at 6 o'clock. They're both in phase again. They're not at 12 o'clock anymore, they're at 6 o'clock, but they're both at 6 o'clock, and they add. And all I did is go another quarter wave downrange. So, quarter wave and quarter wave, half wave. At least you see the mechanism by which every half wave along the transmission line, you'll find another peak. And right now, I'm not going to go through the math, but I'm just going to give you a couple of words. Let me drop. In the places on the line where the voltage is high, like 12 o'clock and 12 o'clock for those two hands, where the voltage is high, if you measured the impedance there, you would measure a very high impedance. If I go a quarter wavelength away from that toward the transmitter, where the big hand and the little hand are now at 3 o'clock and 9 o'clock respectively, and the two voltages are canceling, and there's very little voltage, if I opened up the cable at that point and measured the impedance, I would measure a very low impedance. And then when I go another quarter wavelength down, and they're both at 6 o'clock, the two voltages, I'm back to a very high impedance. So impedance repeats every half wave, not every full wave, because you've got twice the velocity involved. It's very similar to having a car driving down the road at 30 miles an hour to the north, another car driving down that same road going 30 miles to the south. The closing velocity of those two cars is 60 miles an hour, even though both of them are moving at 30. And that's sort of what's happening on the transmission line. One signal is going up the transmission line at the speed of light, very close to it. The other one's coming down the transmission line at the speed of light. The closing velocity between the two, mathematically we can talk about closing velocity, is twice the speed of light. That's another way of saying it's going to repeat every half wave instead of every wave. The phenomena you're talking about with transmission line, with standing wave ratio, is working at two opposing signals. Therefore, it's as if the speed of light was twice as fast. I know this is not the whole story. Maybe it'll help a little bit. But Mel's going to simplify that some more for us. K2KEY, K2RIW.
This is K2KEY. Yeah, you took the words right out of my mouth with the two cars. I was going to say two cars, okay, going 50 miles an hour will pass each other, from, you know, coming from the opposite direction, will pass each other at 100 miles per hour. All right, but basically, let me see if I can put this into some different words. You would think at first that we said that the going up the transmission line was a wavelength long. Why isn't that the SWR, the thing coming back, wavelength long? Okay. So what happens? Why is it repeating it? So at any given repeat impedance would repeat every wavelength. Well, but the standing wave actually isn't one wavelength long. It is actually a half wavelength long. Now, why you ask? And ask me why. Well, one of the waves that produces it is going forward, and the other is going backwards. So they pass each other in just half a wavelength, just like the two cars he just said. Two cars coming at each other. They're going to, each going 50 miles an hour, going to pass each other at 100 miles an hour, but they're going to be right at the middle. They're going in opposite directions. You could say they're halfway. They're meeting each other halfway if they both start out at the same spot. And you measure the distance from one car to another if they both accelerate exactly up to the same point at the same speed, cover the same distance, they're going to meet halfway. That's why it repeats itself at a half wavelength, whereas the signal first going up there is a wavelength long. I think that's the easiest way I think I could put it so far, Dick, over.
Yeah, I'm getting that picture. Now, not everyone's going to get it the first time they hear it. We're talking about phases, we're talking about signals, we're talking about group velocities along a transmission line. There's a lot of terms going on here, whether we've used them or not. And so, you got to hear all this jazz a few times before it makes sense. That's normal. You'll be a little frustrated at first. All new information, when you try to learn it, you're going to be frustrated. The learning process feels frustrating. There are certain individuals out there who just like learning new things all the time. They like being frustrated. I mean, that's a rare individual. The majority of us, when brand new material is exposed to us, we're exposed to, we feel uncomfortable. Because a lot of what we're hearing, we've never heard before. It's got new terms most of the time. And so, those velocities of propagation, velocity factor of cables, it's sort of what we're talking about here. And the actual distance between peak and valley and peak again on a transmission line, if it was an air type transmission line, they would be exactly a half wavelength apart. People used to use twig lead as a transmission line, therefore those two wires, if you take off the insulation, they used to be called Letcher wires. I guess Mr. Letcher was the first guy who did it, and he would put a neon bulb on a stick with two contacts that slid along those wires, and at certain places the neon bulb was bright, and another place the neon bulb was dim, and then he moves it another quarter wave again, and it gets bright again, and he recognized the fact that the two places where the bulb are bright or a half wavelength apart, because it was an air line, and because the signal moves at very close to the speed of light in air, when there's no dielectric material in there, he would measure the wavelength between, he would measure the distance in meters or feet or inches between the two locations where his neon bulb got brighter, and maybe it was an incandescent bulb, but the bulb got brighter in two different places. He'd measure the distance between the two. He would call that half wave, and from that he could calculate the wavelength by doubling that distance, or calculate the frequency by dividing it into 300 million meters per second, the speed of light. So in the early days, Letcher wired repeater.
Time out.
In the early days of radio, these Letcher wire systems, just two long lengths of wire with no insulation as twin lead, and you got some kind of bar you put across it, it's got light bulb or neon bulb or whatever, that was the method by which you measured frequency, by measuring wavelength. Now you got a little bit of a clue as to why we call it the 20 meter band and the 40 meter band. Because in those days you couldn't measure frequency, you could measure wavelength. And if there was 20 meters, if I measured 10 meters between my peaks on my Letcher wire system, I called it the 20 meter band. Because I know there's this 2-to-1 relationship between them. There's only a half wave between the peaks, because there's a signal flowing forward and a signal flowing back. So, and the people who do optical experiments, they talk about a 10 micron infrared source, and they'll talk about a 550 nanometer green laser pointer. The majority of what they do in the optical world, they never discuss frequency, because they don't measure frequency, they measure wavelength. And in the early days of radio, we also did the same thing. It's called the 20 meter band, because for the first 20 years, or 30 years, or 40 years, until we could measure frequency, we only measured wavelength. KQKEY, KQLIW.
Sorry, this is KQKEY. Yeah, I think we'll leave it at that, because I know I'm going to get questions, more questions on it, Dick, and the deeper we get in, the more confusing it gets. All right, let's take one more here, I think. You ready for another one? Over.
Yeah, you and I are bright-eyed and bushy-tailed. Go ahead. We retired people can stay up late if we want to.
Roger. No, we still need our beauty more than ever. Talked about this antenna system, about, you know, people living in the city and places, about problems with antennas and what to do, how to get up, and here it is. I knew that my friend was going to stick this on me with his antenna. He lives in a city, we wound this helix antenna, helix dipole, and people have been asking, how the heck did you make this thing? How do you go about winding a helix dipole? I came up with a method to do it, and I think it would work out fairly well for anybody. I mean, there's a couple of questions. How the heck do you put this thing together, you know, and make it, you know, so that it's a easily assembled and disassembled, Dick, over.
Yeah, if I took a real wire dipole that's a half wavelength long and resonant, and then I decide that, well, I want to make it more compact, I'm going to take each one of those wires, the one to the right and one to the left, and wind it in a helical manner. If I did that, I'm reasonably sure the antenna would be too long, even though it was exactly the right length of wire that I wound, because the wire wrapped into a helical form has extra inductance, so those the magnetic field couples between those turns. You build up inductance as you do that. It takes a shorter length of wire to hit resonance again when you do that. Now back to you, Mel.
Actually, now, with also with the helical antenna, you have a certain amount, you know, of length to work with. The big problem is, how do you wind the coil? How do you get this coil wound? And I figured out a method of winding the coil on one of these things. And how do you know how many, you know, turns per inch and all that good stuff? So I worked out a whole system with it. In fact, I even came up with a formula idea. And as Dick says, the wire length work out to possibly a little, well, a little different, actually. But not too far off, almost, you know, almost exactly by using 468 over the frequency. And you will get the wire length that's fairly close. And the way I made it, you can, of course, a little extra wire. You can always prune it, you know, to make it resonant exactly on the band that you want, such as in this case 20 meters. So let me let it drop. So the most of the problem is that you want to, you know, how to wind it on the get it nice and even, the coil. In other words, we actually call that linear loading. And people have said to me, is that better than putting a loading coil somewhere out on a wire? And, well, I don't know. I think that maybe linear loading in a case like this with a foreshortened dipole may work better than putting a loading coil at one specific spot, Dick, over.
Yeah, that's a slightly controversial area, Mel. If I used large enough diameter wire of high conductivity, so that I've got very low loss raw materials, then the insertion loss of the antenna will always be zero. Whether I made it a great big lumped coil at the bottom, a medium-sized coil in the middle, or another sized coil at the top, or linear loading along the whole length, neatly winded, sloppily winded, bunch the winding at the bottom, and stretch it at the top, vice versa, all of those will work with 100% efficiency. If I use large enough diameter wire of high enough conductivity, if you have any doubt about that, a very simple experiment will prove it to you. Run that antenna after you resonate it. I'm going to discuss that on the next transmission, not this one, how you hit resonance. But after you've resonated that antenna, you're happy with the way it works, pour 10 watts or 100 watts into it, key down, for a couple of minutes. Turn off the transmitter, run over there and touch the antenna. If anything has any loss, the temperature rise caused by that loss will be sent by your hand and your fingers very rapidly. Any reasonable length antenna, if it was wasting 1 watt of power, my hand would easily sense that as an increase in temperature in that area. I'd know exactly who's eating my lunch. Maybe it's the connector doesn't have a good solder joint and it's running hot. I'll know it immediately by touching it with my finger. So lots and lots of people think that, oh, you get tremendously higher efficiency if you build the coil at the top end instead of the low end, if the coil is wide-spaced or narrow-spaced, if the coil is large diameter or small diameter. Bull. In my opinion, use the right materials for the job, every one of those antennas is going to run 99.something% efficiency. Efficiency is not what we're talking about here. And how you hit resonance, that's another little bit of a trick. The RF energy is amazingly forgiving. You can make the sloppiest looking coil where it's bunched in one end and spread at the other end. That RF will find its way, and it will radiate itself into...
Repeater, time out.
You have a... It's like going to confession all the time. That RF always goes to confession. It will forgive all of the sins you make in the way you constructed that antenna, as long as you use the right material, low-loss material. That antenna is very forgiving. That's a strongly felt opinion. I built all kinds of very ugly-looking, weird antennas that the experts said, no way in hell is that going to work. Done properly, it works like a charm. The very first transistor that Jacques-Louis Bourdin and Bretagne built in 1947, the homeliest-looking thing in the world. The electrons didn't care. It went through that transistor, and it had gain anyhow. The RF choke that you wind can be homely as all hell. As long as you wind it on the right coil with the right materials, it will work. And these loading coils for the antenna, you'd be amazed how forgiving that is. If you say those words on 20 meters on Saturday morning, there'll be a whole bunch of people roaring at you and saying all kinds of nasty things. I say they're wrong. See what Mel says. K2KDY, K2LIW.
I used to fight that war many a time, not on 20 meters, but on 75. Everybody, usually I explain a number of these things on, and I don't want to get into it, but some of the emails are quite colorful about our explanation and what we think. All right, but here, getting back to this helical antenna, the question was, how do you go about making one? They would love to, because this person, one person I know that has it, he's up 22 floors. He's got it out on the windowsill. It's 10 feet from tip to tip, and runs on 20 meters, and it works out quite well. So how did I go about it, basically? That was the question. That's what I basically explained to the people here that I know, a number of them, and interested in making it. I'm going to give you a formula that I came, basically. I don't know where I saw this formula. I'm sure it's not my original formula, but I think more or less what I came up with. Here's the formula I'm going to give you now and explain what this formula means. T, like in Tom, is equal to the square root. You're going to have to use math. I can't make this thing up for you in any other way but math, but it's not that complicated, the math. So let's do it again. T is equal to square root of S, like in Sam, squared, minus L squared, divided by C squared. Now I'm going to explain that formula. Let it drop. Okay. S is for the length of wire that you're going to use. In other words, you know 20 meters. You need 33 feet of wire. Okay? And you know the length. Let's say in this case it was he's using 10 feet of PVC pipe to wind the helix. And C is the length of a turn. Now, how do you know? You take a piece of wire. In our case, we use number 22 wire white. Everything stayed white because the building is all white brick. And also, when this thing was installed out on the windowsill, I went downstairs. I just casually started looking up. I couldn't spot the thing, even though I knew exactly where I was looking. So what happens is now, this is going to give you the number of turns that is going to be required across this PVC pipe from end to end. I wonder if you understand so far, Dick, what I'm saying. Over.
Yes, I do, with a slight ambiguity, Mel, just to make sure that people are putting the division in the right place. I think you said tango T equals square root of all that's going to follow, open parentheses, Sierra squared minus Lima squared, close parentheses, divide by C squared. And all of that's inside the square root sign. And the denominator is C squared. The numerator is S squared minus L squared. As one great big fraction. If we don't say it that way, somebody may divide the C squared into the L squared only, instead of dividing it into S squared minus L squared. K2KEY, K2RIW.
You're 100% right. This is K2KEY. You do the inside, as Dick just said, as one thing. You take S squared, you minus the L squared, and that figure is then divided by, as Dick said, C squared. Then you take the square root of it, the whole thing. That gives you the answer for the number of turns that are going to be required to go across this piece of PVC pipe. When you have now the dimension of the pipe length, you have the number of how much the wire takes to go around one turn of the pipe, and you also have the space, how much space is going to be occupied. In other words, you got all those figures. Now the only thing left is what, how much do you space out each turn along there? In other words, you want to mark off. So every time you make a turn, you hit so the thing is nice and linear across the whole length of PVC pipe. So here's what you do: you take, you just divide the length of the pipe by the number of turns that we just came up with. So let's say we came up with we divide it out and it comes to 3-inch spacing. So you mark off on this piece of pipe with a piece, with a, you know, a magic marker. Every 3-inch you put a dot, so that every time you make a turn, you hit that dot. And that way it'll make you a nice, even coil right straight across, Dick, over.
Pastor XZF? XZF, I think it is. Say it slowly and give us your name, sir.
Yeah, November 2, X-ray Zulu Sierra. Name Robert. And I got a quick question on this antenna. Sounds interesting and I might try it out, but I have a quick question.
Go right ahead with your question, Robert.
Yeah, the question is, just going off theory, it may not matter, but how thick is the PVC pipe? Because if, well, it really doesn't matter, the thickness of the PVC pipe. Because my guess is, if the pipe is thicker, you're going to need more wire. I mean, we got the turns, but you're going to need more wire. Is it still going to be tuned?
Okay, when you say thickness of the pipe, you could be talking about diameter of pipe or wall thickness of pipe. Diameter of pipe is what's going to generate how much wire is required for one single turn. But wall thickness of the pipe, I think, is going to have a very minor effect because it's an insulator. It's going to have a minor effect. Is that sort of what you're looking for, Robert? Go ahead.
Yeah, I was looking at the diameter, because if we, if it takes 33 feet, let's say, and let's say that the dimension for a full, for a 20 meters is 33 feet, if you wind it on a 2-inch thick pipe, you'll still have the 33 feet, but what I'm actually getting at is the turns we got from the formula, but the length of the wire is going to change depending on the thickness or the diameter of the PVC pipe. Now, the length, is that going to make a difference as far as the antenna being tuned? In other words, the length of the wire makes a difference. Because if I wind, I can wind it on a 2-inch pipe, a 3-inch pipe, a 5-inch pipe, and it will be a different length of wire.
You're absolutely right, Robert. It's going to be a different length of wire and a different number of turns. The formula accommodates that. The formula tells you how many turns, once you've chosen a band, and a diameter of PVC pipe. You keep saying thickness, and I know you mean diameter. So once you've chosen the diameter of the pipe, and the length of the pipe, you've chosen that for mechanical reasons. You may decide that I'd like to squeeze the whole antenna into a 10-foot length, because a 2-inch diameter piece of PVC pipe, 10 feet long, I can support that on the balcony of my particular apartment building at the 22 level floor. And I can connect that to the railing. So You select the length of the pipe, you select the diameter of the pipe, you've already selected the band, and I gotta ask Mel, the S is the length of that particular band. If I'm operating on the 20 meter band, where a half wave dipole on the 20 meter band would be, let's say, 32 feet long, is S in that case for 20 meters equal to 32 feet? Or is it equal to roughly 64 feet, 20 meters? You plug in the real length of a half-wave dipole for S. K2KEY, KQIYW.
Roger. In other words, we're taking a dipole and we're squeezing it down, like you said, one many times you can twist them and you can turn them well. We're taking it to extreme. We're rolling it up on a piece of pipe. And, of course, the C in the formula, that takes into consideration because you are measuring how much one turn, the length of one turn wound around the form. So that adjusts the, that, you know, for the different situations, whether you use 1 inch of PVC, inch and a half, 2 inch PVC, whatever it is, that turn is going to be, you know, require a different length of wire because the pipe diameter. And the L in there is the length of the space that it will occupy. So with this situation, you know, you've got everything. Now, one other thing about matching. So in other words, you're actually just making a dipole on 20 meters would be 33.3 feet approximately to operate the low end of the band where he operates on CW purposely. So that's why in a case like this, you know, a good idea maybe to work CW. And so he's got 33 feet of wire. That's the complete amount. And you can split it in two in this case because if you don't want to wind it one straight run across the, you want to do it in two halves, you can do it in two halves, Dick, over.
Yeah, you think this formula would work for both a monopole and a dipole. And I'm going to strongly recommend that people always use this formula as a dipole. If I was setting up what looks physically like a monopole hanging off of the railing of my balcony of my apartment building, of my apartment, I'm going to be feeding it at one end. It's going to look like a monopole. But if I am smart enough to make it a half-wave electrically long antenna wound on that piece of PVC pipe, I know I'm going to get a lot more performance out of it. I don't have to build a set of a great big ground plane radios. I don't have to build a counterpoise. A simple little metal railing that's on my balcony will be more than enough counterpoise that I can feed it against. The slight disadvantage is I'm going to be feeding one end. I'm going to be feeding roughly 1,000 ohm impedance. If I fed it in a J-pole-like manner, that's easy. Or I got the choice of building a loading coil at the bottom, an impedance matching device, where I'm tapped up some number of turns on the feeding coil that feeds the bottom of the helical antenna. So feeding it at the bottom, where the impedance is roughly 1,000 ohms, 800 ohms, some big number like that. Double huge advantage once you get around the fact that you have to build some kind of an impedance matching network. All the books we read tell us how to match a 70 ohm antenna to the center of the center insulator of a half-wave dipole. Well, you're not going to feed the center of this thing, in my opinion. You get the greatest performance if you're smart enough to feed the bottom and you make it electrically half-wave long. I wonder if that's your recommendation also, Mel. K2KEY, KQIYW.
Didn't work out that way. Thought of that originally, did some, well, whatever I could model on NEC. Got a little bit of a hint there and everything. And I decided they were going to stick to a classic dipole here. So, and it worked out quite well, and here's what I did. I cut it right in the middle, right in 5 feet, a 10-foot pole piece with the coil wound on it, right in the center. I cut it, and I measured it there as a dipole, and I got about, I think about 12 ohms. The impedance I measured was 12 ohms. I then made up a simple 4-to-1 vallum, a 4-to-1 vallum, Dick, and the goddamn thing worked so well. He had no RF back in the shack or, you know, back to the rig or anything. No, nothing coming in, you know, getting into the, his TV or computer or anything. So basically, you got a dipole here that's been really, like, squeezed down. But it is 33 feet of wire on as a half-wave dipole on 20 meters with this match, a 4-to-1 match in the center, Dick, over.
So if I understand you correctly, you started off with a dipole in free space that would have been 33 feet long, 20 meters, half-wave dipole. When you wound it on the 10-foot-long piece of PVC pipe, which I'm going to guess was 2 inches in diameter or something like that, are you saying that the length of the wire was still 33 feet? I'm amazed that it didn't become a little bit shorter. And because you said it measured 12 ohms, that tells me you used an antenna impedance meter, probably made by MFJ, or that other three-letter abbreviation, I can't think of it right now, AEA, I think it is. But you've got an antenna impedance meter. You made the antenna a little bit longer or a little bit shorter until the reactive component measured on the antenna meter went to near zero, and what was left was 12 ohms of resistance. And then by a half-wave coax balun, a 4-to-1 impedance step-up device, that's the way you fed the center of the dipole. So did it take 33 feet of wire when it was wound in the helical manner? I'm a little bit amazed by that one. K2KEY, K2RIW.
A little bit more wire, and I pruned it down to get it to the frequency. I remember that when I did some trimming and everything like that, Dick, I don't remember exactly how much we took off. I never really measured it, just kept playing with it. Once I got the setup like that, with this, in other words, once we wound the full wire, maybe it was 36 feet or whatever came out. In other words, we added a little extra wire. It was, you know, actually used number 22 white wire. Telephone wire, actually, for a strand that you know, that the telephone company uses, one of that white wire that they have. You know, they have the white, the green, the blue, and a little in a sleeve. So we just stripped it out in the white because we wanted the white to be on the PVC pipe, the white PVC pipe. So everything is really camouflaged, and again, the building is all white brick. So you can't. I tried to see the thing from the ground. I couldn't see it. Really, couldn't pick it out. And I was definitely looking, knowing where to look. And so, no, you, so in other words, it is what you would say cut to be a half-wave dipole, Dick, with this matching 4-to-1 balun in the middle, over.
Okay, that's a beautiful way to do it. I would like to also experiment with feeding it at one end. For mechanical reasons, on the balcony of an apartment, or hanging out the window, feeding one end is a little bit easier than feeding the center, in my opinion. But either will work. And if you feed it at one end, it's a lot easier to make it a vertically polarized dipole. And you're feeding it in the center, hanging it out the window, it's a lot easier to make it a horizontal dipole. You can still do vertical, but a little bit easier to make horizontal. Any of these techniques will work. And so making it resonate, even if you don't have an antenna impedance meter, you can still hit resonance. It's just going to take you a little bit more experimenting. You're going to be measuring the standing wave ratio at the low, center, and high end of your favorite band. You know that the real standing wave ratio curve is going to be a bathtub curve, and you're finding out where the bottom of the bathtub is. If the bathtub ends up at the high end of the band and you want it to be the low end of the band, you know you're going to be adding some extra wire. If the bathtub ends up above the high end of the band, you're going to see a continuous slant across the band. You'll know that the bathtub is at the high end versus the low end by looking at the slant of the curve of standing wave ratio versus frequency as you tune to 2, 3, 4, 5 different frequencies in the band and measure the standing wave ratio and plot it. You'll see a bathtub curve almost all the time. And because you know you're making the antenna mechanically shorter, the curves that are in Chapter 4 of the Antenna Engineering Handbook, curve 4-3 and curve 4-4, where you can see those curves by going to the Tom Williams website, WA1MBA.org, Whiskey Alpha 1, Mike Bravo Alpha .org. Go to the bottom of the page and look at the K2RIW impedance matching, and you'll get those curves. So when you've mechanically shortened the antenna, the impedance that used to be 70 ohms is going to go down toward the 12 ohms that Mel used as his example by a prick
repeater. Time out.
It's going to go down by a predictable amount. So even if you don't want to experiment with re-measuring the impedance match of a resistive component, those curves are going to tell you ahead of time exactly what the resistive component is going to become. You make the antenna shorter, the resistance goes lower. By doing nothing but adjusting the electrical length of a dipole, you have the ability to make the resistive component anything you want, from 1 ohm to 1,000 ohms inclusive. That's a beautiful knob you've got in your hand, and the average guy doesn't know that knob is there. We got 1 minute left. This was TechNet number 1244. Even though there's a Dayton next week, I'm pretty sure there will be a TechNet next week. Back to you, Mel.
K2YO question.
Mel with his sign out first. Go ahead, Mel.
Let me just say the final words. The reason also, I've said it in the middle, it's 4-to-1 balance. By the way, if you want to make the balance, it's in the antenna handbook, the RL antenna handbook. They show you a very simple way to make a 4-to-1 balance if you want to homebrew it. The reason in the middle, because the two windows come together. It's a double, you know, double windows. And the center support for the two double windows is in the middle, so we can tie it off that way. So it became also a convenient spot to not only put the balun, but also to tie this thing and keep it from flying away. In fact, we put cords up the PVC pipe both ways and end caps on the PVC, put a cord through both ways, and the cord, in other words, ties off. This way it sort of gives us a little, you know, more tight support, so it won't blow around. So, and take it in, and folds actually puts it under the bed when it goes away.
Repeater.
So,
yeah, I'm now on the eastern input because it will come through the machine, even though the machine has turned off. Bernie, K2YO, if you can transmit on 147.375, I will be able to talk to you. If you can't, I'll listen to you on the input of 25. K2 Yankee Oscar, K2RIW. Okay, what Bernie asks is, can you top feed it, or it must be bottom fed? If you make it a half wavelength long, and it's a half wave dipole, whether you feed the left side or the right side doesn't matter. So when you say when you top feed it, does that mean you want to mount the dipole hanging down instead of hanging up? How are you going to get your transmission line to the top of this dipole, which is 10 feet long, and you've mounted the bottom of it to your railing of your balcony? How are you going to get the transmission line up to the top? Over to you, Bernie. I'll hear you on the input. Okay. Bernie wants to hang it down from his balcony instead of up. And the balcony is the counterpoise, and whether the counterpoise is on the top side or the bottom side, for the most part, doesn't matter. It would matter a little bit if yours was the penthouse apartment at the top of the building, and you aimed it up with the dipole aimed up, you'd have a little bit more altitude, you'd get a little bit more clearance of the building, and therefore in the direction of the building, you'd get a little bit more performance. But under ordinary circumstances, a dipole that hangs down or hangs up, vertical dipole, behaves the same. You'd be amazed how many commercial antennas on towers are on a side mount, and some of the monopoles are pointed upward, and some of the monopoles are pointing downward. They all work like a charm. K2YO, K2LIW. Okay, Bernie, if you do build the antenna, please come back and let us know how it worked. 73, you all. K2LIW is clear.
Good night, K2RAW, to B2RAY. Your audio sounds louder. This frequency is on 85, by the way.
Interesting. Then I'm louder on this frequency. Okay. My guess is the audio is a little bit more muffled, but I'm not sure.